Today on the 21st, it's New Year's Eve, and we're wrapping up our year-end listen back to some of our favorite segments from 2020. Earlier this month, the Cleveland Indians baseball team announced it would change its name after the next season. This is the second major professional sports team to announce such a change this year. It came in the wake of national protests for racial justice and calls for racially insensitive mascots and brands to be replaced. Today, we're revisiting a conversation about the legacy of a controversial mascot right here in Illinois. Then we'll talk with our very own team here at the 21st, recapping some of our most memorable segments from the show this year. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. In 2020, national protests around the movement for racial justice reignited a call for replacing racially insensitive mascots and team names in sports. We saw the football team in Washington, D.C. change its name prior to the NFL season in response to mounting pressure for what was widely considered racist and offensive to Native Americans. And this month, the Cleveland Indians professional baseball team announced it would change its name following the 2021 season. Given that, we thought it would be a good time to revisit a conversation we had here on the 21st back in August, exploring how the retirement of a mascot isn't necessarily the end of the story. Look no farther than the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, which retired its race-based mascot, Chief Illiniwek, 13 years ago. And yet, in many ways, depictions of the mascot persist, with some even calling for the chief to be restored. Back in August, my Illinois Public Media colleague Brian Moline was guest hosting the 21st and spoke about this with three guests. Lee Gaines is an education reporter for Illinois Newsroom, who has reported on the U of I mascot for the NPR program Here and Now. Matthew Sakaistua Gilbert is a former professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and is now head of the Department of American Indian Studies at the University of Arizona. He's also a member of the Hopi tribe. And Carol Spindell also joined the conversation. She's a writer and former lecturer at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and author of Dancing at Halftime, Sports and the Controversy Over American Indian Mascots. Here now is that conversation, again hosted by my colleague Brian Moline. It was originally broadcast back in August.
Lee, I'd like to start with you. Can you give us a brief introduction to Chief Illiniwek and help us understand why the character is such a presence on the U of I campus?
Sure. So for those who aren't familiar, this is the University of Illinois' former mascot, but it had quite a run here. It started back in 1926, and then it was officially retired in 2007, so 81 years that it existed on this campus. It obviously changed over that time, but something that was sort of a staple of these performances is that at halftime at football and basketball games, someone dressed in, Native American regalia with a feather headdress, often with face paint, often with face paint that is the colors of the U of I, blue and orange and white, would come out onto the court or the field while the marching band played and would do quite an athletic performance, I will say. They would dance around, they would do these high kicks and split jumps and, face the crowd. And they always had a really stern look on their face. Actually, a former portrayer of the mascot told me that you weren't allowed to open your mouth while you were performing as the chief. And then what happened is that this became, an extremely divisive issue in the early 2000s. The NCAA basically said that universities with offensive Native American mascots and imagery, including the chief, would have to get rid of them or they would be barred from hosting certain postseason games. The University of Illinois fought that decision initially. So this was back around 2005. They appealed it. They were unsuccessful. And so ultimately, the decision was made in 2007 to end the run of this mascot.
And Lee, why 13 years after that decision, after the U of I's mascot was retired, is this still such a contentious issue?
Well, how long do you have, Brian? because this is, I think, the central, you know, when I produced this story for Here and Now, which is a national NPR show, I think this was the central question of that piece. You know, I think a lot of people, especially on the outside looking in, and as myself, a relative newcomer to this community, I've only been here 2.5 years, I really was confused by that. But I think this character has such a deep history in this community. Like I said, it goes back to 1926. It's not something that the community wants to, a certain portion of the community wants to give up. They feel deeply attached to it. They don't think that it is racist or offensive. Well, there is another large portion of this community that does. So it remains a divisive issue. And even today, you have unofficial portrayers of the chief popping up at games. You have Facebook groups with thousands of members on them, you know, dedicated to resurrecting this mascot. And the university is also aware that it's an issue, and they've taken some steps or made some efforts over the years to try and move the community past this mascot.
Matthew, I'd like to bring you into the conversation here. You were a professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in 2006. You saw the chief perform at a football game, and you had a very telling interaction with the person sitting next to you. I'm hoping you can share that with our listeners today.
Yeah, so it took place in the fall season of 2006. I had just arrived on campus to start a postdoctoral fellowship program in the American Indian Studies program. And a friend from church actually had invited me to one of the football games. And of course, I went. I'd never been to one of the UIUC football games. And, you know, for the first half of the football game, it was just your typical game. But by the time you got around to the halftime, everything kind of looked different. At least from my previous experiences. One of the things that I noticed is that people, a number of people did not leave to get up and use the restroom or go to the concession stands. They were all waiting. What were they waiting for? They were waiting for this moment when the band would start and start with the 3-1 and Chief Alina would start to move and weave in and out of the band. And the energy and the excitement that was in this stadium was something else. I had mentioned to Lee Gaines when she was writing her or working on her story that it felt like these people were having a religious moment. This was a mystical type feeling that people were having. And there was a lot of energy there. And while we were watching this, there was a woman that was sitting next to me, and she asked me what I did. And I said, I work at the University of Illinois, and I teach in American Indian Studies. And she says, well, are you an Indian? And I said, I'm a Hopi Indian. I'm from Northeastern Arizona. And I just remember what she said. And she said, Well, why don't you get down there and you become the chief, and then it'll be okay. Everybody will be happy because it'll be more authentic. And I've always, you know, one of the things I've always tried to remind people that this issue and this topic, the Chief Olainowick, is not about authenticity. I think many people can agree that there's nothing authentic about this regalia and this representation, these dances that Chief Olainowick does. It's not about authenticity. It's about representation. And I think people need to understand that, and they need to realize that when they think about this topic.
I'm curious, Matthew, what you took away from that interaction back some 14 years ago.
That this was not just a university issue. This was not just a university problem that campus was going through. This was a community issue. There was this larger community. And as Lee had pointed out, this symbol, this representation This dance of Chief Illiniwek has been around since the 1920s. It's deeply, deeply embedded into this community. And one of the things as well that people need to realize, there's what is going on campus, right? And I know that the campus wants to move forward, and I think the campus can move forward in certain direction, but there's also this community that really doesn't care what campus administration says or policies. These are individuals who love the chief, who want to keep that symbol and that tradition going. And these are people who are also paying money to watch these football games, putting money into the athletic program in that way. And so there's this community group that shouldn't be overlooked in any way.
Thanks for that, Matthew. Carol, I'd like to bring you in here and maybe zoom out a bit for a bit of a historical perspective. You've looked extensively at the history of the University of Illinois' mascot, and in 2000 you published a book titled Dancing at Halftime, Sports and the Controversy Over American Indian Mascots. I'm curious why you began researching this character.
Well, I was teaching writing, nonfiction writing at the university. Since I started teaching there in 1989, and I moved to the community in 1984. So I started teaching writing, and my students wanted to write about it. And of course, you want to encourage your students to write about things they're passionate about. But the essays would come back, and they would all contradict each other. And so we couldn't really have a discussion. Some people would say, oh, he was a historical figure, Chief Illiniwek. No, he was invented. No, he was an Illinois Indian. No, he was, you know. So I went down in the university archives and began doing research. And I realized how little I knew about white Native relations, and really just began to be fascinated by the topic of this white mythology about American Indians. I had no idea that imaginary Indians were such a huge demographic in our country, but it turns out they are a very large demographic, and they play a very large role in sort of non-Native Americans' consciousness. And they go back, really, if you want to know a little bit more about where they come from Wild West shows. If you think of these young men at the university in the 1920s creating Chief Illiniwek, they came from little Midwestern towns all over Illinois, and the big event of the year was the arrival of the circus. And part of the circus tradition, these circuses arrived on trains with horses, with tents, with teepees. Part of the American circus tradition was the Wild West show. And if you think about it, most of these mascots, no matter where they are in the U.S., look the same. They look like young men, and they wear those long feather headdresses. And the reason for that is because Wild West show actors were recruited from the Great Sioux Nations. In fact, some actors were paroled into the Wild West show. Most Americans do know about Wounded Knee. It was one of the few white Native interactions that I learned about when I learned American history. And the surviving leaders of Wounded Knee were imprisoned in Joliet, Illinois, and then they were paroled directly into Buffalo Bill's Wild West show to reenact history, according to Buffalo Bill. But of course, it wasn't really history. It was this imagined history in which the Indians always attack. They attack the stagecoach, they attack the wagon train, they attack the settlers' cabin. These were all vignettes that were performed all over the country. And then at the end, they ended often with Custer's last stand. So in the end, they attack Custer. So these kind of scenes, which were an invented history, have entered our national consciousness, because when the Wild West shows faded out and the circus tradition started ending, they were filmed, these vignettes. Buffalo Bill's Wild West shows were filmed, and those became the first Westerns.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we're talking about race-based mascots, and in the context of present conversations on this issue, we're looking back at the past and present legacy of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign's former race-based mascot. Our guests are Lee Gaines, education reporter for Illinois Newsroom, Matthew Sakayastua-Gilbert, former professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, now head of the Department of American Indian Studies at the University of Arizona and a member of the Hopi tribe, and Carol Spindell, who's a retired U of I lecturer lecturer who wrote a book on the subject in 2000 titled Dancing at Halftime, Sports and the Controversy Over American Indian Mascots. And we do have a call right now. Alex joins us from Boston, Massachusetts. Alex, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. I actually was on your program back in 2016 when I was a student, helping lead a student government push to find a new mascot. And so it's just really telling that well over a decade after the retirement of Chief Illiniwek, 15 years after academics said that, you know, Native American mascots are a detriment to Native American students and their development and their growth, that this is still a subject. I think Carol would, I'm sure, can agree that, I don't know if she saw that as early as 1912, the Daily Illini was referring to the football team as the Illinois Indians. So, you know, there is a lot of roots in the football program looking back to this moniker that really we just have to be able to move on from. Students have a vested interest in the success of the football program, I think more than the common fan. The common fan may spend a few hundred dollars on a season ticket, maybe make a few donations, maybe upwards of $10,000 usually. But a great many students are spending tens and tens of thousands of dollars. I nearly spent $200,000 on my education there, and I had certainly a vested interest to the success and the reputation of the institution. And I really just find it sad that we're still having this debate so many years later, and now in the midst of this national crisis on race and identity, and how we can still not put the chief question to bed and find a replacement to really settle it. Yeah. You know, it's just disappointing.
Sure. And Alex, thank you very much for that call. We appreciate it. And we'll continue this conversation about race-based mascots coming up after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st.
This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we're re-airing a conversation about race-based mascots, and specifically the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign's former mascot, Chief Illiniwek. My Illinois Public Media colleague Brian Moline was guest hosting for this segment with our colleague Lee Gaines, a reporter for Illinois Newsroom. They were joined by Matthew Sakaistua Gilbert, a former professor of American Indian Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's now head of the Department of American Indian Studies at the University of Arizona and a member of the Hopi tribe. Also in the conversation was Carol Spindell, author of Dancing at Halftime, Sports and the Controversy Over American Indian Mascots. Here is Brian Moline with the rest of that conversation, originally broadcast in August.
Lee, I know you spoke to a number of people on both sides of this debate. I'm wondering if you can tell us where the pro-chief efforts are coming from and what sorts of things they say about his legacy here at the University of Illinois.
Yeah. So the people that support this mascot, I mean, when the decision was made to get rid of it, a lot of people felt deeply saddened, extremely angry. This is something that this is an image, a character that they grew up with. A lot of people, you know, had been coming to University of Illinois games since they were a child. They have an emotional connection to this performance. As Matthew mentioned, you know, it's almost a religious experience for people. And they feel very strongly that this is not an offensive representation, that it's a respectful representation. And, you know, even that it encourages people to learn more about Native American history. So there's a lot of reverence that people have for this character. And there's, you know, there's also a lot of, clout or, respectability that goes into playing this character, getting the opportunity to be this character for people that actually support the mascot. So I actually spoke with the last person to officially portray the chief, and I believe we have some tape of that interview. His name is Dan Maloney, and he was the last person to perform officially as Chief Illiniwek.
The intent of Chief Illiniwek was always to hold a culture in reverence and encouraging people to learn about it. When that's removed, especially when it's such a strong source of inspiration to many, many people over many, many years, it can be tough to move forward.
And Matthew, if you could, I'd like to hear your reaction to Dan's take on Chief Illiniwek.
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, when I served on the commission over a year ago at the University of Illinois that Chancellor Jones put together to deal with or to address this issue of Native imagery. Dan was one of the individuals that was on the committee, and I got to know him a little bit and really do appreciate his perspective on this, although we think differently about the chief. One of the things that I always found really interesting is that those portrayers of Chief Illiniwek one of the things that they always, you know, want to remind people is that the dance was actually a really small portion of what the duties of the Chief Illiniwek, maybe 10% of what Chief Illiniwek did. The other percentage of duties and roles of Chief Illiniwek dealt with, you know, going out into the community and teaching people about Indian culture and Indian ways so that they could have appreciation for American Indian culture. And, you know, that we've got at the University of Illinois, the University of Illinois has an incredible American Indian Studies program that has a number of courses on American Indian history and culture. And you could take courses on Indian sovereignty and learn about Indian representation. So that's already there on this campus. That's the responsibility of that program in a way, right? And these individuals and these faculty, they're trained in this. And many of them over the years have come from indigenous communities. And so they can speak authoritatively about their own cultures and histories. And so this idea that the chiefs was going out there teaching people about American Indians, when in fact the university actually has an incredible program there on campus that does just that. And, you know, one of the things that I tell people is that, you know, Chief Illiniwek might be an inspiration to people that might get them interested and engaged in some facets of American Indian history, culture, but you're not going to be learning about Indian sovereignty. You're not going to be learning about tribal sovereignty and government and some of the current issues that Indian people are facing today. But you will if you take one of these courses there at the U of I.
Thank you for that, Matthew. We have another caller now. Let's bring in Al from Princeton, Illinois, third-generation University of Illinois graduate who is a chief supporter. Al, you're on the air. Your thoughts on today's topic?
Well, thank you very much for taking my call, and I appreciate the input from all the people that are on your panel. It's been very enlightening and very interesting. Like you said, I'm a third-generation fighting Illini, my nephew's fourth-generation. But my question is, when the NTA came out and said that the American Indian mascots were hostile and abusive, why wasn't Chief Osceola at the Florida State University, who rides out onto the field in war paint, carrying a flaming spear and throws it into the ground at the Doak Campbell Stadium, why isn't he considered hostile and abusive? If one is, they all should be. And I thank you very much for taking my call. It'll be interesting to see what the panel has to say about this aspect of it. And go Illini.
All right. Thank you very much for that call, Al. We'll get some reaction to that comment here in just a moment. We do have another caller who can't stay on the line very long, so we want to get her on the air as well. Kelly from Utica, Illinois, joining us this morning. Kelly, what's your perspective on this issue?
Well, my perspective is, I understand they feel loss of this token mascot they have, but what about the people who lost their entire culture? Okay, I live by Star Rock State Park. And there was an old stone house north of Star Rock across the river that was an Underground Railroad part of. But anyway, it's, around it is a historic Native American burial area. And it's also part of something called the Zimmerman site. And I'm not sure exactly on the details, but I know Star Rock was a wintering area for the tribes from this area. And there's no funding for this site. There's nothing for it. How about the people who collect all this money for their football mascot? They say they want to really do something about the identity that was, you know, how about some funding for things like that? Not just that site, but sites throughout Illinois. You know, there's no history of it, you know, and we walk on their graves every day, including those people. So you lost 30 years of history. So what? These other people lost how much? Think about that. Think about the big issues, and, you know, and I appreciate you letting me make that comment.
All right, Kelly, thank you very much for your comments. Carol, let's bring you back in here. I'd like to first get your reaction to Al's question, asking about the mascot at Florida State University. I'm assuming you did some research on that for your book as well. What's the difference between what's happening at Florida State University and what happened at the University of Illinois?
Well, I have to say that personally, I agree with the caller. I think all the mascots are offensive, and I think they should all be retired. That's my personal opinion. And in fact, I wrote the United States Commission on Civil Rights resolution urging all schools to retire these names, logos, and performances. So that's my personal feeling. And I think it also hurts not just Native students at these institutions, but non-Native students, because it teaches non-Native students that it's okay to stereotype another group of people. And I think that's a dangerous lesson in a very diverse society like we have. But there is the issue of sovereignty. Matthew brought that up. Matthew mentioned that if you're gonna learn about Native Americans today, one thing you would learn about if you really studied them was sovereignty. Therefore, in the way the NCAA set up their evaluation process, and as I said, I personally don't agree with it, but this is the way they set it up. The Seminole Tribe of Florida had sovereignty over that particular mascot, and they chose to endorse it. And they have a long, now they will tell you all kind of things, like, but I will tell you that until the NCAA evaluation process, there were no scholarships at Florida State for Seminole students. There were very few Seminole State students who had ever gone there. And when the NCAA came around and began asking questions, they did begin to change that. They made the costume more authentic. They began to provide scholarships for Seminole students and do a number of things. They always had a relationship with the Seminole tribe leadership, which, you know, that's just the way it was. There was a relationship between the state government, the state university at Florida State, and the Seminole tribal leadership.
Thank you very much for that, Carol. And Matthew, I'd like to bring you back in here for just a second. You know, if you had any thoughts to add on what Carol was talking about with Florida State, that would be great. I'd also like to get your thoughts on Kelly's comments just about investing in Native American sites across the state of Illinois.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate what Carol had said. You know, this is we talk about tribal sovereignty and the Seminole Nation, and they have the right to do that. And you know, I don't know what kind of agreements that they made with Florida State to allow that or to be okay with that. But they, as a tribal nation, they have the right to do that. But we also have the right and the freedom to critique that in certain kinds of ways. And you know, there's one of the things that I saw early on. I spent 13 years at the University of Illinois. And when I arrived on campus, I really began to see this, that there was sometimes a disconnect between Native people who are back home in our own communities, Indian reservations, and those Native people who had the opportunity to really think and to critically study these kinds of topics at colleges and research universities. When I went to the U of I, before I went, actually, I had a friend out at Hopi who reached out to me and said, hey, you know, you're going to that university with that one chief. And I said, yeah, I am. Will you send me back a hat with that symbol on it? And so, you know, I always remind my students when I used to teach at the U of I that we're very privileged to sit in a classroom and to discuss these kinds of things here on campus at a major university. And, you know, we were able to look at these things critically.
Lee, I want to bring you back in here. How has the university dealt with this controversy and the divide that it's created on campus?
Well, I think, you know, Carol and Matthew can also weigh in on their feelings about how the university has dealt with it. There's a lot of criticism over how the university has dealt with it. But most recently, they, as Matthew mentioned, they had this critical conversations where they were hoping to get a lot of people in the room to talk about the very issue that we are talking about today. And then last year, Matthew and also Dan Maloney and a number of other people, including alumni, including a former portrayer, in addition to Dan, and also some students served on this commission to try and create a way for the university to move forward, to kind of put this chief debate to bed once and for all. It's interesting. I did reach out to members of that commission. Some of them told me that they did not feel comfortable talking to me without the university's permission. So I wasn't able to talk to them. I was very grateful that Matthew and Dan agreed to talk to me. And I also heard from a student on that commission, Vikram Sardana. And it's interesting. He and Dan fall on absolute opposite ends of this debate. Vikram does not, you know, agree with the chief mascot at all, whereas Dan is a lot more, you know, he's more sympathetic to it, to put it mildly. But they both did not feel like that commission, you know, solved anything. I think they both felt, you know, they were unhappy with the results. And what the results said was that they needed to find some way to memorialize this character, Chief Illiniwek, and that the university also had to create new traditions, a new mascot, something to replace the chief with, because he really has never been replaced. And a lot of critics of the university's handling of this situation will say that is one of the big reasons that we are continuing to have this debate on campus, why this remains a controversy. So I did reach out to the university, and a spokesperson there was not, you know, willing to grant me an interview with an administrator about this, but they did tell me that Chancellor Robert Jones expects to share next steps in the coming weeks. And those next steps will include a process to develop and implement new traditions. There was a caller on the line earlier who's a student who said that students are clamoring for this. I think it's also worth noting that student government held an election of sorts earlier this year, and they voted in favor of a new mascot. It's a kingfisher, which is a blue and orange bird native to Illinois.
All right. Thank you very much, Lee. And we just got just a couple minutes left here, but I want to get Stephen from Urbana on the air here quickly. Stephen, just as I mentioned, just a couple minutes left here, but your thoughts on this topic.
Hi. I was I'm a member of was a member of the faculty for 35 years, and I'd like to add something to get directly at Brian Moline's question that initiated the discussion, why has this persisted? And I believe it's persisted because there's been a lack of leadership at the top of the university administration, at the chancellor and president's level, to actually explain to all constituencies why it is the correct thing not to have a race-based mascot any longer at the university, and to stop the university from promoting racism and the perpetuation of racism towards Native Americans. And one might ask, well, why is this? And it comes down to the fact that the Board of Trustees and some members of the Board of Trustees have been very active proponents of maintaining Chief Illiniwek. And they, in fact, have threatened the jobs of presidents and of chancellors, including the current chancellor at the University of Illinois, from acting further on this. Mm. So what we've seen in the absence of that leadership is more committees and more studies and more discussions. But what is really needed is for the administration to step forward, in my opinion, explain to all constituencies why having a race-based mask.
All right, Stephen, I'm sorry, we're out of time for this segment, but thank you so much for your call. We'll have to leave it right there. Thank you to Lee Gaines, Matthew Sakaiastua, and Carol Spindell for all joining us here on the 21st. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. It's our last show of 2020, and we are looking forward to being back on the air live next Monday with all new conversations. But first, earlier this month, here at The 21st, we gathered as a team, online of course, and talked about some of our favorite episodes and moments from the show this year, each of which showcases what we think makes The 21st the show it is. And of course, The 21st would not be what it is without listeners like you. This year, you've called and texted in with questions and answers and really engaged with the conversations we have on the show every day. And you've also helped the show financially by supporting your local public radio station. Our program is produced by Illinois Public Media in Urbana, but we air on 5 stations across the state. So today, at the end of the year, we're asking you to support your local NPR station, wherever you're listening from, be it WILL, Illinois Public Media in Champaign-Urbana, WCBU in Peoria, WGLT in Bloomington-Normal, Northern Public Radio, WNIJ in DeKalb, or NPR Illinois, WUIS in Springfield. Again, please consider supporting your local public radio station with a financial contribution to make sure you and everyone else in your community can still hear not only the 21st, but trusted local journalism, which is needed now more than ever. Okay, now that we've covered that, I want to bring in 2 of my producers for a brief recap of the year at the 21st. I'm joined by Ryan Wild and Anna Casey. Hello, Ryan and Anna.
Hey, Brian. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to be here on the other side of the Zoom call.
We have been having a lot of conversations about the pandemic this year. Obviously, it is the major news story. A lot of those conversations are around health and mental health in particular, including sleep. And you produced a segment back in May related to COVID-19 dreams. Tell us about that.
Yeah, definitely. So there have actually been studies where people have reported having more vivid dreams since the start of the pandemic. So we wanted to talk about this on the show with a sleep specialist and also see if there was any sort of truth to that and get some tips for how we can sleep better during this very stressful year. That might be an understatement. But one of the great things about the show just in the last few months, and especially as more people are at home, is that we're hearing a lot from listeners and we love to get audience engagement. And for that sleep segment, we actually started with a voicemail from a listener named Max. And here is what Max had to say about his dream.
I had a dream that I was cutting my hair and I cut the whole top off and I was bald. And I was cutting it with snippers.
I think an 8-year-old with a Friar Tuck qualifies as a nightmare, but that's just me.
Yeah, so he shared his nightmare with us, and we wanted to pose that question to Dr. James Wyatt. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Rush University Medical Center. He studies sleep, so this is really his area of expertise. So we asked him if people were having more vivid dreams during the pandemic and if there was anything that we could read into them. And he said that he doesn't really assign a lot of psychological significance to dreams, but he did say that, you know, a lot of whether or not we remember our dreams depends on our sleep cycle and has a lot to do with memory processing. So here's what he did say about pandemic dreams.
One of the factors that I'm concerned about is with more people reporting more dreams, oftentimes, if you're reporting more dreams, what if, and it's sudden change, for example, in your sleep, what if that means your sleep is becoming a little more fragmented? Because perhaps you're sleeping at different times than you normally would have, or you're under greater stress. So it's not always a good sign to have more dreams.
Fascinating conversation, Anna. I remember that one well. It was part of a series we were doing back in the early days of the pandemic focused on mental health. Mm-hmm. And it's something we've been bringing back a little bit more as the pandemic has been unfortunately ramping up again. Another great thing about working on the 21st is getting to work with students at the University of Illinois, where Illinois Public Media is based. Students like Eunice Alpesan, Zainab Qureshi, Brielle Skullark, and Chantal Vaca. And we asked about their most memorable moments, and Chantal sent us this voice memo.
Of all the important conversations that the 21st had this year, my favorite one was with Myra Ramirez, who was the first known COVID-19 patient in the U.S. to receive a double lung transplant. This conversation with Myra was my favorite one this year because we heard about her experience contracting the virus and surviving 6 weeks on life support.
I'm still the same person. I don't plan on changing who I am. However, I do feel that I have a purpose and I was provided the second chance for a reason, whether that is to be an example for the medical community or if it's simply to share my story and let people know the severity of this virus and how it is real and how if it affected me, it can affect them. And, you know, if they don't want to take care of themselves, at least do it for those more vulnerable around themselves. And if that's my purpose, then I'm okay with that. But I still plan on enjoying my family, enjoying my dogs, spending time with my boyfriend, and living life to the fullest through my line of work and helping in the community.
I hope that this conversation with Myra provided listeners with an inside look at what it's like to be sick with COVID-19. And I hope that by listening to her story, it prompted listeners to take precautions and follow the CDC guidelines for social distancing and wearing masks as we navigate further through this pandemic.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. That was one of our interns, Chantal Vaca, introducing a clip from Myra Ramirez, who was interviewed on the program earlier this year. We're revisiting some of our favorite segments today in the hopes that it will inspire you to support your local public radio station wherever you are hearing us now. Please visit their website, look for the donate button at the top of the page, and know that your support of your local public radio station makes not only the 21st, but everything on public radio possible. In addition to covering COVID-19 this year, one of the other big stories we were following has to do with police violence and the quest for racial justice. And even before the police killing of George Floyd ignited the national protests and conversation on this topic, we had the opportunity to hear from a young man here in Illinois about his experience with the police. And our news director here at Illinois Public Media, Reginald Hardwick, shared with us why this segment moved him.
Jalen Butler is a student and member of the swim team at Eastern Illinois University. In February 2019, his team was headed back to EIU from a meet in South Dakota. The team stopped at a highway rest area in Rock Island County. Butler was the only African-American on the bus. He was taking a selfie to post on social media while wearing his university coat when police officers descended on the rest area searching for a fugitive. In February of this year, Butler told the 21st show what happened while officers forced him to lie face down in the snow.
One officer had his knee in my lower back, another with his knee on my upper my neck. I was being handcuffed. I was on the ground, laid down, trying to express that I was on the swim team. I kept saying, I'm on the swim team, on EIU swim team. My bus is right over there. I kept trying to get them to understand that I was on the swim team and that I couldn't have possibly done anything wrong. After I said all that, another officer kind of knelt down beside me and placed his handgun up to my forehead and told me that if I kept moving, he'll blow my head off.
Jalen Butler was placed in police custody, even as employees of Eastern Illinois University vouched for his identity. Butler, who is 5 feet 10 inches tall, was released. Later, police arrested another black man who was 8 inches taller and 70 pounds heavier. I chose this segment to highlight because at the 21st, we are not afraid of talking about the issues of race and social justice. Butler chose few outlets to share his story, and we were one of them. Later this year, as protests rose after the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, the 21st talked about the role of race and ethnicity and how Illinoisans see each other today and in the future. We hope your support will help us continue those calm, respectful conversations on the 21st.
Thank you, Reginald. Back in studio, or at least in our virtual studio, everything is done by Zoom these days. I want to talk now with producer Ryan Wild about one of his favorite segments from this year. It also came in the wake of the mass protests and calls for racial equity and justice this summer. Ryan.
Sure, Brian. So I think some of my favorite segments on the 21st are the conversations that really explore the human side of news stories in ways that you might not hear or read elsewhere. And I think a really good example of how we strive to do that here is from a segment we did back in June. So one thing that was born out of that moment was this reevaluation and reckoning that we saw with longstanding racist stereotypes from brands like Aunt Jemima, and even right here at the University of Illinois with the controversial mascot. And at the time, there was a lot of news coverage about Quaker's decision to pull the Aunt Jemima brand. And here on the 21st, I feel like where our coverage really stood out amongst the rest was that we were able to connect with a member of her family, Marcus Hayes, who was a descendant of Nancy Green. So here's a clip of Marcus sharing this very human side of Nancy Green.
Sure. So I am her great nephew. It would be like great to the sixth power. And who she was, I mean, she was a mother, a sister, a niece. She was a woman who made the best out of her situation. She was born into something that she didn't ask for, but made the best out of it. She founded one of the oldest churches in Chicago. She used the money that she had for the community. She was a voice for equality. She was way more than what we could ever perceive her to be from a box.
Anna, last clip goes to you. The conversation about the brand Aunt Jemima and the real life woman Nancy Green is just one of many conversations we had about race and racism. One of those was specifically about racism as a public health issue. Can you talk about this last clip we're going to hear today?
Yeah, so after the death of Ahmaud Arbery, the young black man in Georgia who was killed by two white men when he was out jogging, we had a conversation on the show with Kurt Streeter, who's a New York Times reporter who covers sports. And he wrote a column called Running While Black. And on the show with him was Helen Neville, a professor of African American Studies and Educational Psychology at the University of Illinois. And she was describing in academic terms kind of, you know, the effects of racial trauma and how that can manifest, and sort of describing the impact of systemic racism on mental health. But she shared this personal story that really stuck out to me. And this is what she said.
I took our granddaughter, who lives with us, was 12 at the time. We went hiking in a beautiful little area that's about 30 minutes away from Champaign-Urbana. And I decided to treat her and one of her friends to lunch. And we stop off at this little diner. It was really cute. But my granddaughter was raised in Georgia, much like the place where, you know, when we're talking about Ahmaud Arbery. And she's like, I don't feel safe in this little town. I don't want to go into the restaurant. So I convinced her to go in. And for the entire time that she's eating, she's telling me how scared she is, how she doesn't know what's going to happen, how they don't stop off in towns like this in Georgia. And she was so worked up that after we ate and were leaving, she was vomiting. So this idea of what we're experiencing, it's impacting our youth too, because they don't have some of the coping mechanisms that we have built up over time.
Well, what a powerful story. Thanks for bringing that clip with you today, Anna. And we're going to have to leave it there. I just want to say thank you so much, not only for being with me today, Anna Casey and Ryan Wild, but helping produce what is a really powerful show day in, day out, week after week, through what has been an incredible, incredible year for news.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Brian.
Thanks, Brian. We'll see you on Zoom later.
Always on Zoom. And that is all the time we have for today. Before we go, I once again want to thank you, the listeners, for making us at the 21st part of your day and part of your year. And one final request this year to ask if you are able to continue supporting shows like the 21st, that you consider going to the website of the station you're listening to us on now and find that donate button at the top of the homepage so your local NPR station can continue bringing you the 21st every day, as well as the trusted local journalism that is only possible because of your generous support. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Our interns are Zainab Qureshi, Briel Skullark, and Chantel Vaca. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks so much for listening and supporting public media. And here's to better days ahead. Happy New Year.